TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Eddie O'Para about getting hired at 2 in the morning, about the early days of social media design, and about the importance of process in designing for today's technologically and culturally fluid environment.
It's never ending. It can always connect to something new. And that's what you have to build for. You have to be as open as possible.
Here's Debbie Millman.
Eddie O'Para made news in the design world last year when he became partner number 17 at Pentagram, one of the world's most extraordinary design firms. He is only 38 years old, and he has already run his own firm and worked across an impressive range of media, from magazines and packaging to websites and software. Some of his work has already made it into the Museum of Modern Art. He is a true star of his generation, and there is no doubt his career will be followed with great interest in the coming years. And we have him here today on Design Matters. Welcome to Design Matters, Eddie. It's so great to have you here.
Thanks, Debbie. It's really good to be here, too.
So I read that when you first joined Pentagram, that you couldn't stop smiling. And at one point, you couldn't get the stupid grin off your face. Your words, not mine. And it is now 5 months since you started. And are you still smiling?
Right now, I'm smiling. Yeah. A lot of nerves. I always smile when I'm sort of nervous.
Oh, and that's actually not a bad way of expressing it.
No.
I know other people, they do a lot of other things.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk quite a lot more about Pentagram. But before we talk about your new position at Pentagram, I want to talk a little bit about how you got to Pentagram. And I understand that your mom is Nigerian, yet you were brought up in London.
Well, my parents came over in the late 50s, 60s, and they came for education. My mother was a nurse, and my father actually went into advertising.
Oh, really? What advertising agency did he work
with? I actually don't know. He never stated. I've actually never asked him. But he remembers the Saatchi brothers when he was, when he was a lot younger. And they were, they were very... energetic.
Oh,
as it
that's
were.
That's a very sprightly. Good political word.
Yes, very sprightly.
And I understand that you were a true English schoolboy with a cap and a uniform and a little book bag.
Right, yes. Every penny that my mother and father had, they actually put into mine and my brother and sister's education. And so we were, fortunate enough to actually go to very good private schools up till the age of 13, 14.
And you were educated by Jesuit priests.
That's correct. All the way through till I was 17.
And it's really in that experience that I understand that you began to understand people in new and varied and diverse ways.
Well, I would say that the Jesuits are partly liberal and also very strict, amazing teachers. And they would always talk about diverse subject matter. And you could also ask questions back without any sort of conservative feedback from them. if you've ever talked to a Jesuit priest, they're actually quite open and quite different from the other orders. And, you know, that experience really solidified what I wanted to do in the future. I was okay at drawing. I would actually, to shut me up at church, my mum would have a piece of paper and a pencil. So when I'd go a little crazy, the pencil would come out, the paper, and I'd start drawing, and I would be really, really quiet.
But I thought it was Margaret Thatcher that really solidified your design career.
Yeah.
Is that a true story?
It's
Margaret Thatcher, the milk snatcher?
Yeah, Margaret Thatcher, milk snatcher. Anyway, growing up in the 70s is tough. Yeah.
Well, I grew up in the 70s too, so you're not telling me anything I don't know.
in Britain, you know, Britain was seen as the old man of Europe. There was a lot of strikes in the early 70s and mid 70s. And up till the time Margaret Thatcher came into power, things were pretty much wayward. And so when she arrived, everybody thought this is going to be great. She's going to save Great Britain to a certain degree. A lot of people think that she did. But for me, it really came down to a day when I was in class. I actually was drawing, so nice and quiet. And teacher came in and said, unfortunately, boys, your milk is gone. We have no more milk for you. And you can blame, I don't know if she actually stated it was blame Margaret Thatcher for that.
Now, why did she take away your milk?
Because she took everybody's,
What was it about the milk?
Well, you get free milk. All the kids in all schools, private and public, state-based, would get milk for free. And I loved it. You know, I loved my break times when you have the milk. And it was about, you know, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning. And she took it away. She took it away from me.
Gosh.
Yeah. Oh, bitch.
I was going to say that. Yeah. You beat me to it.
Exactly.
Did the press come up with the headline, Margaret Thatcher, the milk snatcher?
Yes.
Okay.
They did. So, you know, I trudged us home and actually asked my mum why. And she started talking about conservatives and the Labour Party. And our family we're very Labour orientated. And she said that she's taken away everything, a lot of things from the state, from the people. She, you know, I started learning more about the Labour Party in regards to giving back and the sense of community and, you know, the strengths of the NHS, the strengths of the free educational system. And it really delighted me. You know, you have pretty high taxes, but you get it back. And I realized this when I moved to the bigger school. The small school was private. The bigger school was state. And there was a Jesuit state school. And we would intermingle with different classes, you know, upper middle class, and working class kids, boys, all together in one school. And my accent sort of changed from this. So like, or change from this, say mommy and daddy, to, you know, something I have right now, which is a mixture of just like, you know, my name's Eddie, how's it going, to, you know, being rather regal. So it's sort of like an interchangeable like class structure I have in my soul. And that allowed me to be very very open and very aware about giving back and being part of a community, being part of a collaborative unit as such.
One of the things that I kept finding in my research in preparing for the show was the idea that you believe that everyone owns what you do. And I'm wondering if the roots of that mission, so to speak, first took seed when you were in school and being exposed to the theories and philosophies of the Labour Party.
Yeah, that's primarily it. I mean, you've just articulated perfectly.
Well, talk to me a little bit more about what you mean by everyone owns what you do. I know that you tend to be open source in terms of looking at the back end of some of the systems you've developed.
Well, there's the idea of being original. Mm-hmm. And then there's the idea of being open. Sometimes they go hand in hand, and I should explain a little bit more about what I think open is. And I mean, you're really sharing content with one another. The minute you sort of create something, or you thought you created something, somebody looks at it and says, you know what, that's brilliant. I'm going to utilize that as a component of what I'm working on. And so you really don't own the final product. It's part of what everybody actually gave you. More so, in this day and age than ever, when you have work that's created online, or you know, we use the web as a source for inspiration all the time, constantly. I think we're always intermingling pieces from other places and other people.
So you graduated from Yale. You went to ATG, Art Technology Group. You did that right out of school. By 1999, you were already working on social media applications.
Yes, that's right.
How did you even have the idea to be working on a social media application?
Well, it's interesting.
12 years ago.
When I graduated, I actually moved up to Boston. And the first job I had at ATG, Art Technology Group, was for a online application that was collaborative, you know, socially collaborative, for an advertising agency called BDDP. And they wanted us to be as innovative as possible. And so Judith Donath was doing a lot of work at the Media Lab, MIT Media Lab, on social media. And we focused our attention on that and seeing how we could create affinities between people and their content. And so we built this application that would allow the advertising agency to push new ideas into this particular community, and then you would actually have spaces to actually write about that content. And so it was ads or concepts that people had come up with that were part of the company. They would upload that content. They would push into different channels depending on what they were interested in, and then they could sort of talk and write about those ideas. You could also see that your buddies were online, and this was all in a browser. This is not like a, you know, AOL AIM system. This is all in the browser, and it was great. It was a lot of fun.
So when you saw Facebook, did you think that Mark Zuckerberg stole your idea?
No, absolutely not. I think his idea is genius. Sometimes ad agencies come up with, or design agencies come up with, great concepts and great ideas, but that's not the area to create a product and then sell it. They wanted to use it internally, and it was an experiment. And that experiment went actually very well for Art Technology Group. The management system that we built, custom built, was called ATG Dynamo. And from that point on, or actually a little earlier, it was utilized for Martha Stewart, Sun Microsystems, Sony, name it. It's still used. The military use it.
Congratulations.
For a lot of people who had an enormous amount of shares but in the company. Now Sun Microsystems owns that company.
So after ATG, you went to Imaginary Forces. Is it true that you got a call at 2 in the morning with the job offer?
Yeah. I talked to...
Really? 2 in the morning?
Yeah.
You rang, you picked it up.
Yeah.
Hey, Eddie, you want to come work in Imaginary Forces?
I met Mikon van Gastel, who's, I think, an absolutely exceptional designer and creative person. And, you know, at ATG, at the time, we were dealing with a lot of dynamic content. So not many people knew what that was back in 98, 99. Dynamic content is all about changing content on the fly that you're seeing. So he had just won a really big job with Morgan Stanley. I mean, Mikon had worked on this to get this job for about nearly a year before he even started on the job.
What was the job?
It was to do the screens in Times Square for the new Morgan Stanley building on 7th Avenue. And these screens would be the longest and largest screens in the country. They are there today. And we actually did the job.
Are they still Morgan Stanley screens?
No, that building's haunted, you know, because Morgan Stanley,
right,
and then Lehman Brothers, and hey, it's Barclays. So, you know, watch out, Barclays. I bank with HSBC, so.
Mostly because of that then, right?
Yeah. But he wanted to know more about dynamic content and how that worked. And I talked to him about it, and we talked a little bit more, and he offered me a job, and I took it, and I moved to New York.
And so what other types of projects did you work on while you were there?
I actually worked on a lot of ads, you know, Mercedes and Bacardi.
Any movies?
No movies, no. I didn't actually get to the chance to do those. I did some storyboards and stuff like that for movies, but no movies.
Now, here's another urban myth I need to have verified.
Right.
Is it true that when you quit your job, that you actually accepted your new job in the bathroom at Imaginary Forces?
Yes. I think it was time. It was the year to the day that I had started Imaginary Forces, or around about that time. And, you know, I had a sort of rocky beginning there.
In what way?
Tough. Well, my area wasn't so much animation and motion. And I had to learn a lot more, you know, and I did. And it was a lot of long nights. So I was also teaching at Yale at the time. I had also a long-distance relationship at the time as well. So that was taking a toll on me. And so I wanted to sort of try and get back into print and possibly some interactive design, and try and do some other environmental pieces, because that bug had bitten in regards to dealing with Morgan Stanley. And so I went to the bathroom, and Michael Beru had offered me a job before, and called, and I said, I'll take the job, whilst zipping up, I think.
And so then you did the magnificent, magnificent work for Prada. Such gorgeous work. I think that was really when I first became aware of what you were doing. And I still consider that to be some of the most beautiful retail work ever made, ever created.
Well, it's funny you should actually bring that up, because Michael came over to ATG first to ask us for some help in the setting up the new media side of the epicenter in at Prada, down in Soho. And so, unfortunately, ATG declined, and that's actually one of the reasons why I quit there. But my friend Karen Chu at 2x4 at the time, who's also from Yale, did an amazing job doing the first wallpapers there, and it's exceptional. So that was sort of the lead into doing a lot of work for Prada. And, yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Now, when you talk about the wallpapers, you're talking about the wallpapers for the runway shows.
Well, no, it was actually wallpaper in the epicenter.
Oh, okay.
I think started the whole idea of wallpapers for Michael and Susan and Georgie.
And one of the wallpapers is of your naked body.
Oh, you're right, yes. Yeah, that was an interesting one. I think Michael got a call like 2 days before we actually had to, or maybe a day before we had to give in an idea. And he said, do you want to do this wallpaper for Milan show? And I, for Men show. And I said, yeah, sure. You know, and after working on other things part of that day, it was about like 9 o'clock when I started working. And I started doing a lot of typography and thinking this is, you know, messages might be interesting and, you know,
this for wallpaper.
This might be good. And then I had a look at it, and I was like, oh, this is bollocks. And it was about 11 o'clock after I just looked up, and I was like, oh, crap, I've got to really come up with something. And I said, look.
When was it? It was due the next day.
It was due the next day.
So you had one day to do this.
Right. And, you know, I had to send it off to Milan to get accepted. And so I came up with the concept of doing myself. Or just like from a model that was in 3D, but I also said, you know what? I'll do a black guy who's like myself, and a white guy who's like pink, unfortunately, so brown and pink, and it was kind of funny because we sent it off, and I recall I had printed out a larger set for Michael to see, and then Michael said, why didn't you make it? Why don't we make the invitation 6'2"? That's my, you know, my height. And that was interesting. But they didn't go for that. They went for a smaller version. And it was around Christmas time. And I had to leave. And so the files were sent to Milan without me seeing them. And then I see my whole body, balls and all, super nuts, across these walls. I mean, it's
not my
naked body. It's a 3D model, but it was great. It was,
and there were balls.
There were part balls. They were slightly cut off.
Now, when you say you sent
to
them...
make a doorway, of course.
Oh, interesting. I want to talk to you about another an identity that you created when you were at 2x4 for the Brooklyn Museum.
Right.
I'm particularly interested in talking about how you designed the identity as an interpretation of the Brooklyn Museum brand. I read that you felt that brands can never stay still and that influenced the way you designed the identity. And I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I should bring in Michael as well on this because the way that we work at 2x4 was quite interesting. It was a little bit like school that you would have. You'd have great crits. You do these great pinups. Michael would do pinup, put his stuff up on the wall. Susan, Geordie, everybody would put their work up on the wall. You wouldn't really know who did what. And then you go through them and you start talking about them. And one idea would amalgamate to another idea, to another idea, to another idea. And I recall that Michael had done these, like, what he called violators. I think one or two. And I had sort of done these bees that were slightly different, and they were very similar. And so, after talking, he allowed me to just continue on in that mixture, that sort of direction. And so I created 8 different designs because one of the things that I felt, and I think Michael and everybody else at 2x4 felt, is that Brooklyn is so diverse. There's so many different types of people. I mean, Queens is also extremely diverse. But the center, everybody's heart is the same. The love of Brooklyn is there, and that's the B. So the B should always stay consistent, but the outer area, the perimeter, is always different. And so I developed 8 different types, and I thought they only needed to pick one. You know, that's what I thought, that museums or other institutions or companies always pick one design. They picked all 8, and it's interchangeable, and it works really well. And the first time I saw it out in the public, it was summer, and a girl had it in the West 4 subway, and she was holding a nice canvas bag with the logo on it, and had all her stuff in it. I was like, wow, yeah, that's nice.
So you went to ATG, and then you went to Imaginary Forces, so extraordinary firms, and you went to 2x4, arguably one of the best, or one of the best two. And so then you decide to start your own firm, the MAP Office.
Right.
So what made you decide to take your entire team from the MAP Office and go to Pentagram? Just what was it? How long did you have the MAP Office on your own?
5 years.
So 5 years. You get a call from Michael Beirut?
I got a call from Lisa Strassfeld. I knew Lisa from teaching at Yale and also from friends up in Cambridge, Mass., Massachusetts, where she had gone to school. And she wanted me to give a lecture.
Oh, that's always the secret code for we're interested in you, isn't it?
Is it?
I think it is.
I'm not really sure about that.
I don't know. But I think that anybody that's ever joined Pentagram, it started with a lecture. And it's like, would you like to come up and see my etchings? We all know what that means.
So I was like, dumb as a, and I said, yeah, sure. Bit of food, bit of drink. That's great. Smashing. And so I paraded up there with my crew, and we had a blast.
Who was there? So it was Paula, Michael, Abbott, Michael Garricky.
Yep, yep.
You're nervous here? I mean, I don't even know how that's even possible.
Well, I was wearing my lucky pink, fluorescent pink Adidas sneakers. I love Adidas. No, not today, unfortunately. when I lecture, I always have to wear sneakers.
Why?
I was nervous. And it stops me from smiling too much and sort of like, I got to actually say something. And so I gave the lecture and I went to dinner. Paula, she couldn't make the dinner, but she was there at the lecture, and she wanted to meet me another day. And so she said, pick the spot, and picked a spot. And I was asked to, join Pentagram. Actually, when I came back from my meeting, my guys actually asked me, so are we joining? And I was like, what? How do you know? They just guessed.
They know. They know what going for a lecture means.
I really didn't know.
Now, you were born the same year as Pentagram was founded.
That's correct, yes.
And so it was sort of destined, I think.
Yeah.
So you're the newest and the youngest partner at Pentagram. Do you feel pressure?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
What kind of pressure? How come?
Just pressure on myself. you know, you come in the morning, you sort of go through this amazing roll call of Abbott and then Luke and then Michael Garrahy, Michael Beirut, and then Paula, and then it's me, and then I can see Lisa on the other side, and I'm like, holy crap, this is it. This, I've got to really do my best.
Now, I read that you thought that it was a big deal for you also because you're British and you're black. So why do you feel like that was a big deal?
Being black shouldn't really matter in design at all. It really shouldn't. But when I was going to school, I mean, there were few of us who are still mates from the larger college of printing that always worried about, like, having a role model who was actually black. I mean, you'd hear it, you'd see it in sports, you see it in acting, you see it in literature, you see it, you know, in art. But in design, practically nothing. And being black and British, absolutely zero. And so coming here, you know, I recall my first day at Yale, I went to the bursar's office with my brother, and the lady who's black totally nearly freaked out with our accents. And she's like, hold the phone. I have never... And she looked at us both, like, in amazement that we came from Mars with, like, these British accents. And she's like, oh, my God, it's so amazing. Your accent is so amazing. And it was like, and we're black, right? And it's like, come on, love. Give us a break.
Yeah.
You know? And... there is a sense of pressure there. And... you kind of actually hear it from friends who are very supportive, and they say, you know, I know you can do this. This is going to be great for you. It's also great for our community. And
I think it is. It's great for design.
It's a good thing for design. And there's so many designers of from different minorities who are coming up or have come up in the world today. And it should be seen and labeled for their achievements. And I think that's important.
Well, you're certainly the role model for that. I want to ask you about three things that you've said, quotes, that I thought were really interesting. And then I'll let you go. But the first one is, I think you made a poster of this quote for the Wolfsonian. And it's, democracy is the Helvetica of politics.
Okay, right. That was done by the Map Office, my company. It was actually designed by Salvador Arara, a very good young designer. And we had this amazing conversation about democracy and what it meant. And before we even started this project, because none of us did. None of us knew what it meant. And so we started.
So the project was about democracy.
It was about designing a poster for the Wolfsonian in Florida for thoughts on democracy, ideas on democracy, what people thought about it. And so we asked ourselves, what does it really mean to us? And we had these really great conversations between working on different things. And, Salvador actually coined that quote, and it really, really stuck. And it is. It's so default. You know?
So that's what you mean by it?
It's very default.
How do you feel that democracy is the default of politics?
Well, we all have different ideas of democracy around the world. You know, some people don't call it democracy. Some people call it other things. You know, here you have, freedom of speech and great democratic structure and framework. But in other countries that are in Africa or in Asia, they also too have different political ways of thinking that they are actually comfortable with. What we're trying to say is that the American democracy, in a sense, is the default way. So everybody, you know, you have to have freedom of speech, you have to have separation of church and state, which is great and everything. But it feels sometimes that America has a manifest destiny that is quite imperialistic. Oh, crap. This is labor coming out of me again. imperialistic. And it doesn't really work in other countries, as we have primarily seen.
Absolutely.
And so that is really why that was stated. It's a very simple, and every time you use Helvetica as an analogy, you use Helvetica because you can't use anything else. You're just like, you know what, Helvetica will do that.
Yeah.
Because you haven't tailored it. You can't just drop American democracy or British democracy or French democracy into another country. I mean, look at colonialism. I mean, you just can't do it. You have to shape it from that country from within.
The second quote is, process is king, but a queen is a B asterisk, 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 asterisk. I don't think you mean bread or beast. I think you mean bitch.
Yeah.
Process is king, but a queen is a bitch.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
I'm a great lover of the overall aspect of research and development and thus process. I believe that process is actually as good as the final piece itself. And so sometimes the final piece actually looks absolutely crap, but your process was actually really, really beautiful. And there were some great pieces out there. So inevitably, the client's going to pick something that you may or may not like. Queen is a bitch. That comes from a particular set of clients that I've been working with. And that doesn't mean that the piece was a failure. It means as though the piece is very hard. It's a real bitch to deal with. And I just wanted to clarify that for people. It doesn't matter how much work you do. The work may come out irregular and very forceful from the client's point of view, that you just don't want to do it anymore. And you've just got to keep going. And that's the reason why I had stated that.
That's great. Well, the last one is, I think, my favorite. And it is, never finish what you start.
Yeah, never finish what you start, period.
Period?
Yeah. It really comes from, you know, my mom always telling me to clean my room when I was a kid.
So it's a way to get out of cleaning?
Well, you can never really clean your room. I mean, you always try and design a way around it. You're like, you know, I'll just chuck that there and chuck that there. And it's never really finished. You're always going to mess it up again. It's always going to be incomplete. And so that, you could say it's a philosophy, has always been with me. And that's one of the reasons why I really love the aspects of process. Within the process, you've got so many channels that you can go into, so many routes, as it were, the branches that branch out, that, you know, brands or, you know, identities or products today can't really be one single thing. It can't be singular. It's very plural. It connects to so many different channels and conduits that it's never ending. It can always connect to something new. And that's what you have to build for. You have to be as flexible as possible. You have to be open as possible. And from a sort of new media standpoint or development of software that we also do, my team do at Pentagram, you're always versioning. You're never ending. You've always got new ideas. You're always finding out that you've got bugs here and bugs there, and you create new fixes on you. And then somebody emails you about this particular concept or feature that you totally missed. And it's not that you didn't do your job correctly. It's just that, you know, if you sort of focus on users or individuals, everybody has a different way of working. Everybody has a different way of seeing, and so it's going to be absolutely endless. The billions of people in this world have always a way to perceive what a brand actually is. It's never going to end. And, you know, if it does, then it's going to fail.
Right. I think that's what makes it an amazing experience.
Right.
Eddie, thank you so much. I really, truly look forward to all the amazing work you're going to do with Pentagram. And thank you so much for coming today to Design Matters.
Thank you.
If you want to see some of Eddie's work, you can download a free app of Eddie O'Para's portfolio and other Pentagram designers in the iTunes store. And Eddie O'Para designed that application as well. I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions with technical assistance by Rainey Ortica and research by Jen Simon. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes store.